In a world where uncertainty reigns supreme, where shadows of chaos dance at every turn, one truth emerges unyielding. Preparation is not a luxury, but a lifeline. Behold the Wellness Company, a beacon of readiness amidst the tempestuous seas of fate. Envision a sanctuary of tranquility, where the tumult of unforeseen medical crises finds no purchase. The Wellness Company's Medical Emergency Kit stands as a bastion of assurance, a fortress of resilience against the unseen foes of health. Within its sacred confines lie the tools of salvation. Ivermectin, to ward off the insidious whispers of disease. Emergency antibiotics, to quell the raging storms of infection. Antivirals, to vanquish the relentless tides of contagion, and more. The Wellness Company Medical Emergency Kit is not merely a collection of supplies, it is the embodiment of preparedness itself. Crafted by the hands of esteemed healers led by luminaries such as Dr. Peter McCullough, Dr. James Thorpe, Dr. Harvey Risch, and Dr. Drew Pinsky, this kit stands as the pinnacle of safety, the zenith of prevention. These truth-seeking doctors have forged a testament to vigilance, a testament to the unwavering pursuit of well-being. Embrace the certainty that comes from being armed against adversity. Embrace the Wellness Company, for in its embrace lies the promise of resilience, the promise of a brighter tomorrow amidst the chaos of today. Don't wait for the next crisis to strike. Visit twc.health/strangeplanet and use promo code STRANGEPLANET for an exclusive 10% discount. Prepare today and rest easy tomorrow.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Richard Serrett's Strange Planet. Following the truth wherever it leads. Exposing evil and corruption and the secret machinations of powerful elites. Revealing the high strangeness beneath the surface of our supposed reality. Coming to you from the Great White North and his studio beneath the stairs. Here's Richard.
Once again, another episode of Strange Planet. Thanks, as always, for sticking me in your ear. And if you want to get deeper into Strange Planet, I suggest you check out the premium subscription packages available to you. Just go to strangeplanet.supportingcast.fm, strangeplanet.supportingcast.fm. There are three monthly programs to choose from. Choose the one that's right for you. But essentially, you get all sorts of goodies, like access to commercial-free listening, bonus episodes, a subscription to my monthly newsletter, Inner Sanctum, and discounts on Strange Planet merchandise. StrangePlanet.supportingcast.fm. StrangePlanet.supportingcast.fm. Or just click the link right there in the episode description. We're going to welcome back to the program a psychotherapist and author researcher. Who is alerting us to the pharmaceutical myths, the big pharma myths that are really exacerbating our healthcare crisis in North America. Anthony Samaroff is, as I say, a psychotherapist and an economist from Glasgow, Scotland, best known as the author of Universal Basic Income, For and Against. His forthcoming book, None Dare Call It Quackery, has exposed or is exposing how corrupt institutions in mainstream medicine are bound to turn out bad science and harmful treatments. What's more, he shows how we can reclaim our healthcare one by one, and in doing so, fix the system itself. And of course, the ebook available is Seven Pharma Myths, sevenpharmamyths.com to check it out. Anthony, welcome back. How are you?
I'm very well indeed. Thank you, Richard. It was a pleasure to be on your show once, and it's a great honor to be invited back. So I'm really happy to speak to you again. And if people go to seven, the number seven, pharmamyths.com, they can get that ebook for free. And I'm also adding people who download it to my Substack, so you'll stay updated.
All right, let's talk about what are the big cost centers for healthcare? And as you pointed out the last time, I think in the United States anyway, it's something like $4 trillion. Is it 4 trillion?
Yeah, that's right. America is spending $4 trillion on healthcare. Now, the interesting thing is, if America had a system similar to Singapore, they might actually be able to cut that down by 2 to 3 million dollars, $2 to 3 trillion. If you look at the official figures, there's papers. One came out in 2019 saying up to $750 billion of what they're spending on healthcare is waste. But I think that's actually a conservative estimate, because they are measuring it by their own metrics. And when they do so, they overlook the amount of treatment that's happening, which is just unnecessary. I mean, a lot of the time they assume that if treatment's happening, then it must be serving some higher purpose. But as you pointed out in our preamble chat, sometimes rolling into the doctors for a set of screenings, tests that might seem relatively benign, or even your annual checkup, might actually be a bit like, well, if you look for a problem, you might find one. And the payment system in America's in America's healthcare system would encourage you to do so.
Right. We'll get into that a little bit later as well, but I liken it to taking your car to the dealership for just its regular service, its oil and lube job, and of course they'll always try to upsell you. Now there are things, they may catch. Well, it's like, wow, your brake pads are really thin. It's time to replace those. But they'll probably also find, it's your timing chain needs to be replaced, and we found this and we found that, and all of a sudden you were expecting to pay $90, and you walk out of there with a bill for $400 or $500. You mentioned, or we were talking about, in the United States, they spend $4 trillion per year. I'm up here in Canada, and of course we have a total socialized medicine. It's 330 billion, and that's keeping in mind a population of just under 40 million people. $330 billion a year we're spending on healthcare. So one of the big cost centers, as you mentioned, is a lot of treatments that are either unnecessary or they're not working, so but they continue to use them, and then they discontinue them. So it's just throwing bad money after, more money after bad money.
Oh yeah, I can and talk about, and by the way, we can come to all sorts of problems with socialized healthcare as well. We are always asked to compare Canada's system to America's system, or the one we have here in the UK to America's system, and that's a false dichotomy. It's all the same thing. It's well, I wouldn't say it's exactly the same thing. Sometimes there's slightly different problems with each, but fundamentally, they believe the symptom is the disease, and they are paying money from ser for services, which creates the same incentive structure. A surgeon gets paid to cut, and pharmacist gets paid to dispense pills. So the way that the system is set up in both cases, they're both systems that only remunerate sickness, and where money is made from sickness. So, before I get to your question about unnecessary treatments, which is what we came here to speak about in part, let's understand how the system is bound to turn out these results, because we can always look at the branches of a tree. Oh, hormone replacement therapy for women. They did that for ages, and then they said it increased the risks of lots of diseases, so they stopped doing it as much. Okay, they cut a branch off the tree, but they didn't go to the root of the problem. So if I was your financial advisor, Richard, and you came to me and said, And I said, I've got a great deal for you. Whatever happens to your account, I'll make money. But here's the thing. If your account goes up, I'll make less money. And if it goes down, I'll make more money, just so long as I don't bankrupt you. Right?
Right.
That's what the system is saying. If you get sick, they make more money, just so long as you don't die. Right? Now, that creates the incentive to have people teetering on the edge of death with chronic diseases so you can milk them like a cash cow. I'm not saying that most people or even a significant percentage of people in the system have that intention, but that is the way that the wind blows. In economics, we're always taught a system will tend to turn out the results that it's incentivized to produce. So under this fee-for-treatment system, you wouldn't be surprised if people were overtreated. They don't lose money for overtreating people. If you get side effects, you'll be back in for more pills to treat the side effects. Now, that doesn't mean that they're in their lab saying, how can we cook up pills that have the most side effects? But it does mean they don't have the incentive to stop it. In a sane system, the incentives would be aligned in such a way that people would be looking for ways to stop these things happening. I've got a really good example of that. In the USA, hospital, 2 million patients get hospital acquired infections every year, and they kill 100,000 people and cost $25 billion to treat. Now, experts at Johns Hopkins University found out that they could eliminate most of this just by implementing certain protocols. I don't need to go into the reads, but it was very easily done. The thing is, patients who contracted hospital-acquired infections generated about $45,000 more in profits than those who didn't. So I guess that is maybe more of a bias in a private system. But even in a socialized system, the hospitals need to be needed, right? And for all its faults, you can get seen next day or next week in a lot of places. It's becoming less and less like that, I should say. You could for a long time be seen much more quickly in America than you could in Canada or the UK. So each of these systems are kind of dancing around each other, but I think that bring together many of the same flaws. So, sorry, over to you.
Oh, I was just going to say, it can take you 6 months to see a specialist here. That maybe is a topic for another show. And that is, I do not understand this system whereby you have to go to your GP in order to get a referral to an ENT, or an oncologist.
Yes.
I mean, why are they getting a kickback? Why do you need to go to work? You know, I don't understand.
Yeah. I spoke to a doctor just last week about this kind of thing. It's a lot to do with the way that, do you call them GPs in Canada? Do you
general
call them
practitioners? Yeah.
You're general. Yeah. We do too. In America, they call them a family doctor or the word escapes me. So a primary care doctor, we call them general practitioner. A lot of the time, the way that they pay them is like fee for appointment. So the problem with this is they're like a conveyor belt. They're incentivized to see as many people. You need to drive to the office, see the patient, get them out of the office, and then the next one comes in. They don't get paid for all the stuff they need to do, like calling other specialists, arranging, replying to emails and things like that. So the proposal was they should get paid for comprehensive coverage rather than in this piecemeal fashion. That kind of fee-for-service way of paying makes sense for a surgeon. Each operation you get paid for. But I think we should be looking at that kind of thing, you know, comprehensive, not just for the doctor, but for the whole team, for the whole medical team, because then things like not over-treating become finding ways to prevent over-treatment become interesting, because you don't want the patient hanging around forever. You want to see people, you want to help people, and the payment is not dependent on this kind of throughput of patients through the system as quickly as possible. Sad.
Yeah. I was in Greece for the summer, and if you need a specialist, you know, you might get a recommendation from a friend, or you just look it up online. You find they've got their shingle hanging out there on the street. Mm-hmm. You walk in, mm-hmm. and if they can see you, they'll see you that night, or they might say, "Well, I'm kind of busy tonight. Come back tomorrow." Mm-hmm. And you might walk out of there with a bill for, I don't know, 80 euros. No waiting for 6 months. You see.
Oh, wow, that's amazing. Yeah. It's amazing what people get when they pay over the counter, but that's the last thing anyone wants to do, because they're scared. They've been given these scare stories of ridiculous bills in America, which do exist, and they do bankrupt people, and they're dreadful. But that's because the system's insane. I mean, it doesn't have to be set up like that. We've kind of come to the point where we think more is better, and it's good to be, you know, we want another room on the house and another car in the garage and another zero in the bank balance, and that's all good, but it's not the case when it comes to healthcare, but people think it is. So in the 1900s, we had all these infectious diseases that were rampant in New York City, because New Jersey, just across the Hudson River, was like a swamp, okay? And it bred mosquitoes, and every summer the mosquitoes would just fly across the river and start infecting people with malaria and yellow fever. Everyone except the rich people, of course, because they just pack up their stuff and move somewhere colder. Now, it's still true today that being poor is hazardous to your health, and people who are in poverty have much more chance of getting diabetes, and people who have diabetes are more likely to have everything and so forth. But just as New York didn't solve its infectious disease problem by giving poor people a bunch of drugs, they did it by draining the swamp. So what we actually find is that clean drinking water, access to nutritious food, workplace safety, sanitary living conditions, social interaction, being able to get a job, you know, a social network, and those have a much bigger effect on health outcomes than access to healthcare. So I cite some of these examples in my writing. Like in 2008, the state of Oregon, they had some extra money, and rather than give everyone a tax rebate, which might have been great, the state government decided to just put 10,000 people on Medicaid. So the interesting thing is there was no improvement in the health outcomes of the people who were assigned to this, who won the lottery and got free healthcare. Instead, they increased hospital admissions by 30% and outpatients and ER visits by 40%, and they wasted all that money with no tangible benefits. So people were given more healthcare, but it wasn't helpful to them. In fact, we find that people who are on Medicaid are almost twice as likely to die after surgery than privately insured parents, and even more, like 1/8 more likely to die of surgery than people who are completely uninsured, right? So this is like, doctors are trained to treat, and so they treat. More shocking, 14 randomized studies by the British Medical Journal in 2021 concluded that general health checks did not reduce morbidity or mortality. So basically, patients that were randomized into receiving general checkups received up to 20% more diagnosis over the next 6 years, but it didn't improve their health. So I don't know if they're just taking advantage of hypochondriacs, but the thing is, in a sane system, the general checkup might be a good thing. It might help you avoid an illness, But until they fix it, and actually, like, because some philosophers of medicine say, oh, it's very important to the patient-doctor relationship that they have a general checkup. And that might be true in an ideal world, but that's not what's happening now. So, yeah, about, I'll let you come back.
What about screenings? Things like, you know, they're always saying, get your test for prostate cancer or colonoscopy. For colorectal cancer or a pap smear for breast cancer and so forth.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the pap smear is relatively benign, but this I've got a whole chapter I'm writing called Testing the Limits. I like to have my little pun chapters, but definitely when you look at these PSA tests for prostate cancer, I mean, they were doing this for ages. I think they've discontinued it. Even on the NHS website, it says that they were discontinued because they turned out so many false positives that people were being made impotent and incontinent for no benefit whatsoever. You know, I didn't know this, but you know, my own father was diagnosed with prostate cancer and, you know, had it removed. Now I don't even know if he really had it or not. Now that I've looked at the data, you find official sources saying, let's see, at the age of 75, half of males may have prostate cancer, but only 2% of them die from it. So you can have this for years and years and years. In fact, they inflate the cancer survival rates. They inflate the data on how successful cancer treatments are, because they remove the kind of tumors that people are likely to be able to live with for 5 years anyway. And they say, well, we cured them of cancer. A journal in the American Medical Association, 1993, concluded that no treatment at all for prostate cancer was better than any standard chemotherapy, radiation, or surgical procedure. That's JAMA. So,
if you get diagnosed with a prostate cancer, just leave it be?
On average, I'm not saying that's true for every patient, but what the thing is, as many as 30 to 40 times as many cases of thyroid, pancreatic, and prostate cancer are found in dead people than are ever presented to a doctor. So so many people, 30 to 40 times as many people lived out perfectly normal lives with these cancers. They never detect them. They might have never been diagnosed. So the thing is, you need to be careful, because one test can lead to another test, and you're getting radiation. The official figures, the Institute of Medicine estimated 200 billion is wasted annually on unnecessary tests, and the Center for Evaluative Clinical Studies put it at 800 billion. So I cannot definitively say every case of prostate cancer should not be removed, but it depends on the patient. What I'm saying is so many people have these and just live out their lives and never even know they have them. People only find out once they go into the coroner's office. So another example of this was the annual mammographs. Now there's other ways to check. They can use thermography, because tumors are hotter, so they don't always need to use radiation. But even so, now they've discontinued recommending these yearly for women under 50, so they moved to biannual. But so how many breasts were removed unnecessarily first before they did that? I'm just going to read you from an online forum, because it really puts the point across. I'm one of the women you rarely hear from, a woman who years ago underwent invasive and disfiguring breast surgery to remove a suspicious mass that had been identified via mammogram, but turned out to be a perfectly benign and harmless little nothing. not only did I have to endure this deforming surgical procedure, but I also had to suffer the same extreme anxiety, fear, and emotional trauma that any woman faces before going into surgery. When the outcome turns out to be, never mind, it's nothing, relief patients are then expected to be grateful to the brilliant surgeons who saved us and the brilliant radiologists who overdiagnosed us. How many more of us are there out there? So I just want to say, I can't tell you what to do if you get diagnosed with prostate cancer. What I'm saying is everything has its risks and benefits, because you could end up, and it's not necessarily erring on the side of caution, because you could end up impotent or incontinent. Like, and when you look at the actual success of cancer treatments, according, I'm talking about, mostly radiation and chemo, or, you know, surgery is obviously sometimes necessary if you have a tumor impacting on your, you know, colon or something like that. There's all sorts of reasons, but I don't think we should think the tumor is the cancer. What we were taught, is that the tumor is like a landfill site. It's believed in naturopathy, where your body's putting, you know, your body's significantly compromised by the time you have something that size. So your body's smart. It doesn't want to die. So this is what we're told in naturopathy. It's putting all this stuff in the tumor. It's keeping that there away from the body. Cancer is a whole body systemic illness. You have to treat the whole patient. Just a moment, please. I'm just going to look up some references for you.
We'll do this. We'll take a time out. We'll take this opportunity to take a quick time out, Anthony, and come back and discuss further. Big Pharma Lies with Anthony Samaroff right here on Strange Planet.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Have you ever wondered why we call French fries French fries? Or why something is the greatest thing since sliced bread? There are answers to those questions. Everything Everywhere Daily is a podcast for curious people who want to learn more about the world around them. Every day, you'll learn something new about things you never knew you didn't know. Subjects include history, science, geography, mathematics, and culture. If you're a curious person and want to learn more about the world you live in, just subscribe to Everything Everywhere Daily wherever you cast your pod.
The truth will set you free. But first, it will really tick you off. Welcome back to Richard Serrett's Strange Planet.
Welcome back. Anthony Samaroff is with us, psychotherapist, economist from Glasgow, Scotland. Seven Pharma Myths. It's available as a free ebook. Seven, pharmamyths.com. Talking about cancer and how, according to one school of thought, tumors are actually sort of the body's way of, I guess, collecting all of the toxins and so forth in the body and storing them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a symptom. It's not removing the tumor is not fixing the cancer.
Yes, and sometimes you might need to remove the tumor, and then, but the patient needs to be cleaned out from head to foot. Now, they don't believe in detoxification of the body in mainstream medicine. But again, I just don't know how they have the gall to call us quacks and cranks when their own studies, 2017 study published in the BMJ, looked at the survival and quality of life benefits of 48 cancer drugs approved in Europe by the European Medicines Agency. Reached the conclusion not only that chemo did not extend life, but that it didn't improve the quality of life. I quote, "Most drugs entered the market without evidence of benefit or of survival or quality of life. At a minimum of 3.3 years after market entry, there was still no conclusive evidence that these drugs either extended or improved life for most cancer indications. So you've got the government paying for treatment via socialized medicine that their own journals say don't work. Here's another one, 2017 paper published in JAMA Oncology. Of 62 new oncology drugs that appeared between 2003 and 2013, only 43% offered a survival benefit of 3 months or longer. Now, those 3 months might have been grueling and painful. Maybe they should have been just sent off to Hawaii to drink martini with their family, to drink martinis and enjoy their life last months on this planet. Nonetheless, here, 45% were associated with reduced patient safety. 2017 JAMA Oncology admits that 45% of the new drugs approved between 2003 and 2013, 45% reduced patient safety. Okay, so where are the pitchforks? Where are the why aren't these people being thrown out of their prestigious? Why are these people on six-figure salaries when they're poisoning people to death, when they're already poisoning people who are already sick to death? And they're leeching. I mean, how rich? What could this money be doing? All the research on this drugs, all these scientists who are being paid to, and then they get statisticians to fudge the data to get it through the regulator. They analyze the data in so many ways that they can find a way to get to push it through. All of these people should be working to help people. Instead, huge sums of money are being spent on these quack treatments in mainstream medicine, and then the government will pay for it, either in your country or my country through socialized healthcare, or in the USA through Medicare and Medicaid, and through the insurance model.
Well, what have we had chemotherapy around for 100 years? Mm-hmm. Has it been around 100 years since the 1920s, chemotherapy?
I couldn't tell you exactly when it came out, but you know, you can. I know that you can get a new chemotherapy or cancer drugs passed just on the basis that they shrink a tumor, even though the oncology literature is full of studies that say that shrinking a tumor doesn't necessarily lead to longer life or better state patient outcomes, because they can just die of bleeding or an infection or die of the treatment.
Right. But now they're talking about targeted chemotherapy and
right.
Showing some success there. What are your, any thoughts on targeted chemotherapy?
Well, I mean, that's exactly what I'm glad I maybe answered the question in reverse order. Just because a treatment is targeted doesn't mean that they've proven that it extends the patient's life or improves their quality of life. It might, but it doesn't necessarily, because if you can show that it shrinks a tumor, even if that tumor bounces back 6 months later, faster and more aggressively than ever, you can get it approved on that basis. They call this surrogate markers, and because studies are very expensive to do and can cost $1 million a day sometimes, this is how they get treatments passed quicker. They say, oh, that statin lowered your cholesterol, therefore we've proved you're at lower risk of a cardiovascular event. Oh, this has lowered your blood pressure, so that must mean you're less likely to get this related. Oh, this drug makes you less obese, therefore you're less likely to get all of these diseases that obese people get. That's how they approve treatments using surrogate endpoints. This correlates to that. So if we lower this, you must be at a lower risk of that, without actually proving that these treatments have extended quality of life of the patient, length of life or quality of the life. So just because targeted chemo is shrinking a tumor doesn't necessarily mean it's going to make the patients. You know, my teacher said you can't poison people to hell, right? So I've heard of this potentiated chemo and things like that. And I guess what you're just basically doing is you're setting off a bomb in the patient's body and hoping that the bomb blows up more of the bad stuff than more of the good stuff. I'd be more inclined to look at how you could remove as much bad stuff from the body as possible, and then put as much of the good stuff in as possible. You know, nutrients, probiotics, minerals, amino acids. There's never been anything like a radiation or a chemotherapy deficiency in the body seen in nature. You need to know what's poisoning the body and take it out, and what the body ought to build in order to restore its function and put that stuff in.
Just on a side note, and again, probably the subject of a whole, an entirely different episode, but what are your thoughts on all of these so-called turbo cancers that are rising up post-COVID?
Well, I think that the body is not stupid. The body has lots of defense mechanisms. When you were in nature, you might take in a toxin through your mouth and it taught you to puke up or to get a sneeze and to get the runs. And you could even take it through your skin and it would have some kind of way of removing dangerous material, right? The body is extremely discerning over what it lets into its blood. When you inject, this is why you could take a snake venom and drink it and you won't die. But if the snake bites you, it goes directly into your bloodstream and then you die. So if you poked your skin with a lead pencil, you know, and the lead touched your bloodstream, you'd likely die. Now, when you're putting, let's say, I don't know, they had an experimental medical, I'm not saying they had one, but if they did, and they put it directly into someone's blood, they would be bypassing all of these natural defenses. It would skip the mouth, the stomach acid, the all of the processes that your body evolved in nature to stop your blood from getting poisoned. In a sense, the alimentary canal is outside your body, is the outside of your body, in the same way that a cave going through a mountain is not the cave, right? So in the same way that what's inside your mouth is the outside of your body, and we've got walls to protect it. You're piercing the skin and putting toxins directly into the bloodstream. And it works on people who are naive. Someone will look up on the internet and say, oh, there's more mercury in a tuna steak than there ever was in a flu vaccine. I was trying to keep it our little end joke that it wasn't. But it's not the same. It's not the same having mercury in a tuna steak. I'm not saying it's good for you. It would be better that it didn't have tuna in it, right? But your body is much less susceptible to toxicity from something that enters the usual channels, the nose, the mouth, even the ears, you know, God forbid the butt. So that's what I have to say about those and what I suspect, might be causing them. It sounds to me like you might have a similar idea.
I certainly have my very, very strong suspicions. Mm-hmm. Correlation, mm-hmm. Certainly causation. Well, let's do some studies, for crying out
loud. That's such a good thing to say. Yes. So if anyone says that you're anti-science, tell them this. I want to see the science. There's 800,000 completely unvaccinated Americans. I don't know what it's like in Canada or the UK. The CDC could do a very simple study. Take 50,000 to 100,000 unvaccinated people and compare their long-term health outcomes to 50 to 100,000 fully vaccinated people. Who has got more asthma? Who has got more colitis? Who has got more diabetes? Who's got more this and that? And you age adjust it. I want to see the science. The CDC has been asked to do this study and they always refuse to do it. When other people like Paul Thomas and James Lyons Wheeler and Anthony Mawson did studies, what they found out was the more people on their studies, the more vaccines they received, the more of these health complaints they had. Okay, prove them wrong. Do a bigger study. I want to see the science. I would love it. So if anything, It's the CDC who refuse to do the study who are opposed to science. We are told that not one vaccine has been actually tested against the placebo. So do the science. Let's see the placebo studies. We're told that they safety test the vaccines individually, but don't do a safety test on the whole schedule, on the schedule level. One of the things is, this relies a lot on empirical data, which I love. You know, I cite studies all the time. But what we really need to get back to is a simple understanding of how the body works. If you understand how the body works, you won't think of going to chemo because you know that you can't poison your body back to health. You won't think of injecting something that includes formaldehyde, heavy metals, that are the reason why they pick these adjuvants is because they're toxic, so that they can go, look, your immune system goes nuts when we plug this in. That must mean that you're getting immune to this virus. No, your immune system's going nuts because you just injected a bunch of poisonous chemicals into you. So that does not prove that you've been immunized against anything. The only thing it proves is that you had an immune response. So if you understand the body, how the body works, you know that there's no such thing as a deficiency of SSRIs that's causing your depression. Your body is saying, I need vitamins, drug, I need minerals, I run on amino acids, I need water, I need oxygen. And what have you got to give me? I don't have anything of that. And well, what are you doing here? Well, the pharmaceutical company told me to be here. That's why the drug's there. So we need to look at this organism, this beautifully crafted organism, as a biological process that has physiological needs. That's why they did away with the infectious diseases in New York by cleaning up the swamp in New Jersey. What is the quality of the water in your body? Is it a stagnant swamp? Or is your bloodstream clean? Is it delivering nutrients to every one of the trillions of cells in your body? If you clean up the blood, you clean up the lymph, you clean up the liver, the kidneys, you get out of having a leaky gut syndrome. So you're improving the integrity of the wall of the alimentary canal, so that bits of foods aren't escaping into your bloodstream, out of your digestive system. Then many of these chronic diseases will simply go away.
As they did before the advent of certain vaccines,
right?
Like polio.
Yeah,
I got to take another time out. We'll come back and discuss further. Anthony Samaroff, Seven Pharma Biz. Stay with us.
Ladies and gentlemen, the captain has turned on the fasten seatbelt sign. We're now crossing a zone of turbulence. Please return your seats and food trays to their upright position and make sure your carry-on luggage is safely stowed. You're about to leave everything you know behind. This is Richard Serrett's Strange Planet. Strange Planet.
Anthony Samaroff is here. Sevenpharmamyths.com.
Yes.
The number seven. Sevenpharmamyths.com, and you can get the free ebook. We were talking about the body being a biological machine with physiological needs. What else did we need to discuss there before we?
Yeah. So, like, if you look at your environment, if you've got rising damp, you're breathing in mold, the body is, and that's how we saw such a huge reduction in diseases an earlier time in our history, because we've got refrigerators, we've got running water through the tap. Then people weren't just riding around in horses, we got an automobile, so there wasn't horse dung all over the streets. All these things contributed. When people went to war in the First World War, they were again pooping and peeing in the trenches, and then they came back and we heard that they got Spanish flu. But it was just all these dysentery and typhus and all these diseases that they'd eliminated by improving people's standards of living. They were put in conditions where those kinds of diseases would come back. So it all comes back to cleaning the swamp, including the swamp in our own body, because the human anatomy is just a series of flowing tubes. You've got your blood vessels, your lungs, your nerves, your alimentary canal. All of the vital organs are tubes, the liver, the stomach, the bladder. So as long as the tubes are flowing, you're fine. But if they get blocked or constricted or smashed or cut, then you've got your tubes in trouble. So a blood clot, you know, will cause a heart attack or a stroke because the tube got arterial plaque, you know. Similarly, anything happening in the digestive system can result in a hernia. So what we want to do is we want to limit the number of unhealthy things that are coming into the body and increase the number of health things that are coming into the body. Now, obviously, we live in a very toxic world, so detoxification of the body has become ever critical. And these things are becoming popular. Juicing was really popular for a while. Now it's fasting, drinking only water. So that people have come to understand that if you give the body time, drinking plenty of this stuff, filtered water, you can remove a lot of the excess wastes and toxins from the body, feel better, and live a longer, healthier life.
In the time that remains, I wanted to ask you about the medical journals.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good topic.
The peer-reviewed studies. Everyone keeps that's a preprint or whatever they call it. That's mm-hmm. not an actual peer-reviewed study. Until it ends up in the New England Journal of Medicine, we're not believing it. What is the problem with the peer-reviewed process and these journals?
Well, there's so much wrong with that. Journals are meant to provide a source of objective information that medical professionals can go off of. I try and cite them as well. But again, we have a serious assent. First of all, regarding the COVID thing that you mentioned before, I was told by someone that people actually did have more studies on the outcomes of that. No one will print them, just as people tried to produce more studies on ivermectin. But once they decided to focus on these five or six studies that said ivermectin was ineffective, ignoring all of the other ones that said it was effective for whatever reason, I assume that it was effective because it kills parasites and it actually just made people's bodies more efficient by killing parasites. But I don't know, because I'm not sure what COVID is, put it that way. So first
they've
of
never
all
truly what, isolated the virus despite all of the claims to the contrary.
Right. Okay. So I'm open-minded. Okay. So I when I don't know, I'm willing to say I don't know. It did something that people who were working with it said was more effective than them not taking it. People whom I trust who worked with patients have told me as much. So the thing is, the journals are not incentivized to do what you think they're going to do. One of their major sources of income is advertising space. There's been instances where journals have printed something that was unfavorable to the pharmaceutical industry and had advertising money pharmaceutical companies pull advertising out of their journals as a consequence. If that's not enough, your listeners might remember hearing about the Vioxx scandal, the biggest scandal in medicine until this opiate genocide, we should call it, not epidemic, The New England Journal of Medicine and the Journal of the American Medical Association published safety information about Vioxx that was false, misleading, and even fraudulent, that made people think that Vioxx was less dangerous and cheaper, sorry, than cheaper alternatives that had been on the market for years, right? There was a phone-in where one doctor confronted someone from the New England Medical Journal and said, you've got to pull this study because you're ignoring the wider data on it. Like, and he said, oh, we can't go around policing every piece of data we put out. So, but here's the thing.
Just point out is, excuse me, Anthony, 80 something, almost 90,000 people had heart attacks because of Vioxx. Americans, 88,000 Americans, 38,000 of them died from Vioxx.
Right. And in the face of that, the New England Medical Journal made over $700,000 from selling reprints of the misleading article to Merck. So this is how it happens. If we publish an article that's favorable to a pharmaceutical company, we can then resell them reprints, which they send out to doctors. They give them to their pharma reps, and the pharma reps goes out and say, here it is in the New England Medical Journal. This drug's really, really good, right? There's no law against this. There's no regulation against, there's no, right? Pharma reps shouldn't even exist, right? The only purpose, right? I'll tell you why. Because what patients want is the best treatment with the fewest side effects at a reasonable price. And pharma reps don't exist to deliver that. What they exist is to gain a good relationship with doctors and then encourage them to prescribe their company's drug rather than a competitor. Not the best drug, the one that belongs to their company, right? And in a sane world, that would be the role of journals, to deliver good information on the best treatment with a few side effects at the most reasonable price. Instead, whenever they run comparative studies of drugs in journals, it's very funny because whoever funds the, whichever drug company funds the study, their drug always comes on top. It must be like one of the greatest coincidences of all time. I mean, I don't know how it just so happens to be that when Merck funds the study, their drug looks the best. And when GlaxoSmithKline funds the study, their drug looks the best. But almost all studies are conducted by drug companies. They don't even need to provide all of the raw data from their study to the journal to get it printed. The journal could insist. The journal could say, look, if you don't give us all your raw data, we're not running the study, period. But they don't. They choose not to do it. And they don't need to show all the raw data to the regulator either. So obviously, the journals don't see it as in their interests to hold drug companies to the highest standards of accountability. And also, you don't know how many studies the drug company ran on the drug and then just took the two or three ones that made them look the best and submitted those ones. So there's a lot in the way of missing data, and there's no law to say that you need to register every study. If they did, then we'd have access to all the unpublished studies as well, and you'd maybe be able to reach a better conclusion on the actual effects of a drug.
Anthony, final question, and it's a big one. Let's say suddenly you find yourself the head of the NHS in Great Britain, mm-hmm. or you're the Minister of Health in Canada, or the equivalent in the United States. What would you do immediately on day one to dramatically reduce costs for healthcare and also promote a healthier population?
Okay, well, what I would want is to Support and institutions, which I call 3PCs or third party certifiers, to run studies instead of drug companies, and these would be able to cross reference one another and check each other for mistakes. All studies that were conducted in medicine would have to be open book, so that the scientific community could go over it, even hobbyists, and check the methods. That would significantly, we already have this for all sorts of, CE mark for medical devices or all sorts of things, go through third party certification. As for changing the, for making medical care a lot cheaper, the idea of the government funding the healthcare system through taxation is not working, because all that happens is the lobbyists get into the government and it's run by the bureaucracy. What you would want to do ideally is instead get the money paid into a health savings account. You could make this mandatory. They do in Singapore. They've got mandatory insurance in the Netherlands. It's less, it might not please the out-and-out libertarians, but it's better than what we have. Now, once that money is in your healthcare savings account, you can spend it on anything you want, including a gym membership, or exercise classes, and maybe supplements that are that have got good evidence to back them that are accepted and whatnot in terms of prevention, but also to shop around for your healthcare. In Singapore, even the public hospitals have a charge for everything, but they have to be run like a business and turn a profit. When you now, even though you're forced to save, rather, which you're forced to pay for the healthcare system anyway, rather, we've got something called national insurance here that's meant to pay for a socialized healthcare. So instead of that paying that national insurance to the government, it goes into your own healthcare savings account. That means that when you go to get an operation, you've got the incentive to shop around for the best treatment at the best price. And that's where the third part, the three packs or 3PCs, as we call them, could come in handy, because they are now instead of pharma reps, they're now assessing the landscape in terms of what treatments are best and things like that. And they can provide information to doctors. They can provide information online to patients as well. They can have networks of very well thought of practitioners who then go on to teach other practitioners in their methods. And everyone, you now have a community of peers rather than this like pyramid which everyone's trying to get at the top of to control. Once you have patient power, which is the patients are paying even out of their healthcare savings account, you see a dramatic drop in the price of drugs as well. We need to do away with patenting for drugs, because that basically disincentivizes companies from taking risks on new compounds. Instead, they just add a hydrogen atom or something like that to a compound they already have, and then they repatent it. You'd think that they were doing tons of new research and things like that in pharmaceutical companies. They're not. They're just manipulating chemicals that they already have. They already know that they work, making them slightly different so that they can get another patent on it. It also means that everyone's incentivized to like promote these new drugs, even when old treatments have got a better safety profile, are cheaper, and maybe may even work better. So it would be a much more even playing field. It's not about the new treatment, it's about the treatment that works best. So those are just a few of my suggestions. There'll be a lot more coming up in my writings. If you go to 7pharmamyths.com and download the free ebook, I will subscribe you to my Substack, and I'm putting out solution-based materials as well every now and then. I usually put out one article a week, so that would allow you to know when the book's coming out as well.
Fantastic. Great job, Anthony. Great speaking with you again. Thank you so much.
I can't thank you enough for having me on your show and being such a gracious host. And I look forward to speaking to you again in the future.
We will.
A new Richard Serrett's Strange Planet drops every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Subscribe at StrangePlanetPodcast.com.